The From Day One podcast is brought to you by The Bridge and the Made in New York Media Center.
Hi, I'm Nick Bailey, and this is the From Day One podcast. Today we're talking to Sean Hess, the co-founder of the Wanderlust Festival. Sean founded Wanderlust in 2009 with Jeff Krasno and Krasno's wife, Skylar Grant. The idea for Wanderlust fused the trio's experiences in both the music business and the yoga community. Sean and Jeff were the co-founders of Velour Records, and Skylar was a popular yoga instructor and a leader of yoga retreats. The three of them set out to create a healthier and more eco-friendly alternative to the festival experience without compromising on fun. Yoga is the focus every day at Wanderlust, with music at night, as well as hiking, meditation, speakers, and workshops. Event lineups are often packed with noteworthy yogis from all over the world. Wanderlust has grown in every year since its founding. Originally conceived as a weekend festival in California, by 2017, Wanderlust has grown to an 8 multi-day festival retreats and dozens of single-day events known as Mindful Triathlons. In addition to these events, Wanderlust operates 4 permanent yoga centers in California, Texas, and Montreal. And earlier this year, Wanderlust launched an apparel collection with Adidas. The next festival event for them is scheduled for Oahu, Hawaii in 2018. Sean is also passionate about sustainability and has focused a tremendous amount of energy on making Wanderlust events as close to zero impact as possible. This includes amenities such as recycling, composting, biodiesel, and carbon offsets. The organization also sources local food for its events and hopes to offer ride sharing soon. And on a personal note, I've known Sean and Jeff personally for about 20 years through our shared background in the music business, and it's been amazing to watch the incredible growth of Wanderlust. I'm excited to talk about it. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Nick. Great to see you again.
So tell me about the genesis of the idea. I remember Skylar opened a yoga studio 2 floors up from your office in Tribeca, the record label office. Was that sort of like a chocolate meets peanut butter sort of moment?
It's funny. It was exactly the analogy I was going to use. It's really a couple different streams coming together. First of all, Skylar opened Kula Yoga Project right upstairs from us. We started having a lot of interchange with the yoga community. And I think one of the things you realize quickly is how passionate yogis are about not just yoga as a practice, but also as a lifestyle. It sort of represents, it's more of a psychographic than a demographic, really. And so we sort of became entranced with that and obviously started to practice and at least dabble in practice at that time. And Skylar started leading yoga retreats to Costa Rica and places that were attractive, really, to me at that time, more from an adventure perspective. And I went on a few, and Jeff went on a few, and one of the things that we were struck with was that the community that went there was not only very passionate about health and wellness, but also really wanted to have fun. In short, it felt like a very small festival rather than what I imagined to be a more ascetic, you know, period of health and wellness and eating very healthy curds and whey every day. So at any rate, we took that idea and we applied some of the skills that we had developed in the music business. I think the insight from us for the music business, we were both in our 30s at that time. And I think the idea of going to another dusty mud pit, standing fenced in with people throwing up on your shoes, was no longer fascinating to us. We were looking for an elevated experience while still enjoying music and the arts. And so we wanted to fold that concept of a arts festival into a health and wellness retreat. And that was really how Wanderlust was born.
So tell me, what was going on in the music business at the time?
Well, from our perspective, I mean, we started Wanderlust in 2009, which which was long past the peak of the recorded music industry. That was obviously a background for us too. As you know, Velour, our previous company, was a hybrid 360 model record business and management company. But one of our primary bread and butter was still generated through the sale of recorded music. And, you know, that business was becoming increasingly tough. And while I have great respect for the many people who have managed to make it work, I would say that it was increasingly challenging for us, and we started to look around for something else to do. Also, at the same time, events like Bonnaroo and Outside Lands and a bunch of other of the sort of next wave of music festivals were cropping up. We were very close with a lot of the people who created those festivals, and you know, it was an inspiration for us. We didn't want to make something just like that, but it was inspirational how they mixed genres and mixed different, one of the innovations of Bonnaroo really was just having different musical genres that were previously not considered to be acceptable to put together and mashing them all together. And in some ways, I think that core idea was also what we did with Wanderlust with yoga and arts.
One of the things that I thought was genius when you guys did the first one was that you know, the music business, of course, famously was in a free fall to some extent throughout the late 2000s, especially. I mean, really, I guess post Napster, it was sort of the writing had been on the wall for a while, and it almost seemed to accelerate by that point. But one of the things I thought was ingenious, and I don't know if it was by design or not, was the idea that you would match something that people really love and really, really want to do, which is hear their best, their favorite music, see artists, with also something that they also love and are willing to pay a lot of money for, which is not true about the former. Was that a conscious decision? Was that an accident?
Not an accident, although, you know, I think we spent some time figuring out exactly the balance between people's love of concert experience and music and their love of health and wellness and yoga. But I would say that the thing that struck us from the Kula community and on down was that, you know, these young women, and it was largely young women who were participating, were willing to basically spend all of their disposable income on experiences, first and foremost, and then particularly experiences that were healthy and aligned with their personal values and beliefs. And yoga obviously tied into that, but also healthy eating and farm to table and adventure tourism, and you can go down a bunch of other sustainability, a bunch of other aligned interests. And so that was in total counterpoint to what we were experiencing in the music business, which no matter how passionate we were about our artists, and you, of course, in your former incarnation represented several of them, they're amazing artists, but it's very difficult to sell an undifferentiated plastic CD versus another undifferentiated plastic CD. Obviously, the recorded music on it is different, but there are, you know, tens of thousands of new artists that are coming out all the time, and it just was very difficult. So this was something that we felt that we really could contribute to and develop. And to be honest, I think most people in the yoga industry, as such as it is, if it is an industry, hadn't viewed yoga, and maybe from the outsider perspective that Jeff and I had on it. You know, sometimes when you're very close to something, you have a much more rigid set of constraints as to what you think should or should not be done in that. And I think we were a little freer, perhaps, because we were coming at it from the outside.
So one of the things about the melding of music and yoga and the speakers and some of the other things, as well as the sustainability focus, is that it creates what I would see as a much more strong sense of community among the people that are attending. Does that have implications from a business standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, from a sponsorship standpoint?
Yeah. Community is really interesting because it's the glue of every festival event and really most great bands. As you know, Nick, I spent a lot of time early in my career sort of working on the periphery of the jam band movement, which whatever one may wish to say about it musically, and I only say good things, it did exhibit an unbelievable sense of strong community. And really, it was a group of people who were friends and would meet their friends at these shows. And, you know, bands typified by the Dead and Fish and other bands of that ilk, you know, built something that was lasting around community. But when you start something that does have a community focus, what you quickly discover is that marketing, you never market to community. You market the event, you tell the story of what it is. Community is almost what happens as a result of people gathering. And if you create the right conditions, it can develop and grow organically. And that's really what we tried to foster. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the incredible things about yoga and the yoga lifestyle is that, you know, people are highly educated, they're connected online and off, they are going in person to studios, but they're also, you know, on social networks and very active that way. They are following teachers, they are, you know, corresponding and communicating in a way that's highly engaged. And there weren't large-scale events at the time that we started that really brought all those folks together. And as soon as you do that, and you create something meaningful and potentially transformational, which was the goal of the festival when we first started, you know, you really do set up a good condition for, I think, something lasting that's a lot more than just, I don't know, who the headliner is. And that was something we always wanted to escape here. We were trying to create something that was a lifestyle movement, not talent-driven, because I think that's kind of a trap in a lot of ways. And also, frankly, there weren't big talent in the same way that there's Metallica can headline a festival. You know, it's a very different different industry.
I was out a couple weeks ago at the Life is Beautiful Festival in Las Vegas. And, you know, despite many years in the music business, as we've been talking about, I was struck by some of the changes that I've seen, you know, since seeing festivals maybe 5 or 10 years ago, even. Some of them are very obviously funny and superficial, like And that particular festival, they literally had like Instagram stations, like set up photo opportunities for people. Also the differentiation, like the five levels of VIP, the ability to actually buy a ticket that puts you on the side of the stage. Those are two trends that I noticed. Have you felt like part of those trends? Festivals have changed a lot in the past 10 years, haven't they?
Yeah, they really have. It's an interesting question because we're aware of the trends, obviously, and we follow the industry closely. But there's some inherent tension between some of that things and the mission and values of Wanderlust. So we say our mission is to help people find their true north to live a healthy and inspired life. We're connecting essentially people we think of as seekers, people who are looking to improve or live a more inspired life, and with experts, people who have some kernel of wisdom. And obviously, when you start injecting real-time social media use in the middle of that conversation, you're not really helping it. You know, the archetypal photograph of the modern concert goer holding their cell phone up and recording the show and not watching it. I mean, that's exactly what we don't want at Wanderlust.
Absolutely.
So we've had to strike a balance between encouraging people to share, because obviously we want people to know about the experience. And the other thing I'll say about our festivals is that they're incredibly visual. They are at these beautiful mountain resorts. And so the imagery between, you know, people in synchronized yoga poses, but in the Sierra Mountains with stunning views of Lake Tahoe down below. I mean, obviously we want that to be shared, but at the same time, we don't really want it to be shared in a way that gets interrupting. So we've had to balance that. So that's one way. The VIP thing is another thing that's interesting. Yoga is inherently, there is a sense that it is obviously a spiritual activity, and it is for many people, I would say most people who practice it, it is. And commerce and spirituality mix uneasily. And so one of the things we discovered actually in the first year, we had a VIP program, but it felt a little bit off-brand because having special treatment for people or special access to teachers seemed to violate the more democratic norms of yoga. And so we really tried to focus on making an experience that we could characterize as it's VIP for everyone. In other words, there's no fences. You all can eat great food. You know, the experience is beautiful. You know, the whole thing from a design perspective is probably more akin to what you get in the VIP area at a mainstream music festival. I'm not sure it's the most economically rational thing to do, but it is, I think, in line with the values of the community. And that's most important.
Now, speaking of that, it seems to me, having known you for a while as well, that your career has followed an amazing arc of moving further and further away from the establishment, as they put it. You started out actually as a lawyer, is that right?
Yes.
Would you like to elaborate? What happened, Sean?
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, I'm still trying to explain it to my father. You know, it was... It's an interesting thing. I mean, I guess I've always considered myself a generalist. I think many entrepreneurs are generalists by nature. And as a result, that's actually a good skill to have when you're starting up a business and you kind of have to do everything yourself. Despite being a generalist, I found myself on a path to law school. I enjoyed, I think, the intellectual side of the law a lot. But when I went to practice, and I practiced at Skadden Arps for a couple of years, I wouldn't say I actively didn't enjoy it. It was obviously very hard work and a lot of hours. But I think honestly, there was a little bit of an issue that I did not feel that I was necessarily furthering the values or the cause of society in general. I would say there are many deals I worked on that were, I think, you know, we were on the right side, but there were also some I worked on that I couldn't help but feel that we were on the wrong side. And obviously that's your job as a lawyer, but it just made me a bit uncomfortable. I think the other thing, which was much more personal, was the, you know, I had a couple partners that I thought of as mentors and who were kind to me in a place that wasn't always kind. But they were, I just looked at them and I was, you know, in my late 20s, and I sort of thought to myself, I don't want to be you. And it wasn't because I didn't admire what they do or thought that they were smart. And they were obviously very successful and made a lot of money and had nice houses. But their lifestyle was not what I wanted. And I just didn't have a calling to jump through the many brass rings needed to get there. So I had also been a musician all my life. So through a bunch of happenstance, I had been talking to my now still continued partner, Jeff Grasno, about since college. We went to college together about eventually starting a record label at some point in our lives. And I did 2 years of the law gig and was really looking to try something different. And one day there was his brother started a band who a band called Soul Live that I thought was exceptional and was timely. And basically, I had been looking to get out of law, so I quit and opened up shop literally the next day downtown in a recording studio and started the makings of a record label. From there, you know, obviously the story winds into Wanderlust and other things, but it was definitely, in hindsight, certainly not a decision I regretted.
For sure. What are some of the things that, you know, you have to think about? Would you recommend people think about if they're thinking about, you know, jumping off that cliff themselves and starting something?
Well, it's very hackneyed, but I mean, I think you have to really ask yourself what you, how you see your life being in a decade. I mean, you have to ask yourself long-term questions as well as short-term. We all, it's nice to get a paycheck, obviously. In fact, it's necessary to get a paycheck. There are a lot of things that can hold us in places longer than we want. But I mean, I think we're, you know, you're responsible for designing your own future for, to quote my own manifesto, finding your true north. And, you know, I think when I had the realization that I didn't want to be a partner, then it was pretty obvious that I had to make a change. Now, the change I made was admittedly very radical. I had no idea how to run a record label, and it was just something that I wanted to do. So that might not have worked out. And I'm sure there are many other careers I could have done that I would have enjoyed and felt were meaningful. But for me, it's been a little bit of a clawing to find something that matches sort of, you know, I think some desire for social change and social impact in what I do as a career, and also obviously the ability to have a successful, thriving business, because I'm interested in both things. And I really don't know if I found that with Allure, my previous company, but I found that with Wanderlust.
How has being an entrepreneur sort of differed from what you thought of it when it was just an idea in your head?
I'm not sure it's different per se. I would say that the thing that's striking about being an entrepreneur is that you go through many phases. The skills that get you off the ground and make you initially succeed to a certain point are often the exact opposite of the skills you need to run a mid-sized company. And that was shocking to me. When I, you know, the being a generalist, for instance, is a great thing. When you're an entrepreneur, I'd say it's almost necessary, because you, there's no way you could ever hire enough people or you have the capital and the resources to actually create the staff and get everything done. So it's totally advantageous. But what that leads to is some degree of control freakishness, and also sometimes it makes it difficult for you to separate what you're great at and what you're best at from what you're merely good at, because companies don't succeed by having a bunch of people who are good at something. You succeed if you can attract a bunch of people who are great at what they do and allow them to do that. And that was a very hard lesson to learn.
Tell me a little bit about how you ended up here in Brooklyn. You guys are in Greenpoint now. How long have you been here?
I think we moved here in 2010.
It wasn't exactly a popular spot for business relocation, was it?
No, but it was cheap.
That's an old true story. And what's your impression? I mean, you were living in Brooklyn before, and then the company, the record label was based in Manhattan, right?
Yeah.
Did it feel like the time had come to move to Brooklyn? Was there any thought behind that?
You know, it's funny. We spent a long time debating. I remember it seems so anachronistic now. We spent a lot of time debating of whether, oh God, will anyone come visit us in Brooklyn? Will we have to always go into Manhattan to have a meeting? And all of those questions. And it turned out that yes, people would, and pretty soon people wanted to. Now it's sort of, I think, popular. It's people like to have meetings around this area because we can go to Five Leaves. You know, I think it's definitely changed a lot. I mean, you know, obviously the rent has more than doubled in the time, and that's one striking thing. But I mean, at the same time, the community and the availability of great food and, you know, just sort of the entrepreneurial community. I mean, downstairs from us is the Yard, the co-working company that's got a few offices around the city. And, you know, we've taken a few offices there just for overflow because we didn't have enough space up here anymore. And it's just great. You know, you're with this community of people who are all amazing, young, active entrepreneurs. And, you know, just seeing that energy and feeding off it is great for us.
Tell me a little bit about how you guys work sustainability into Wanderlust. There's so many different things when you're dealing with a festival and an event. How do you even start thinking about that?
Yeah, it's a complicated subject, and frankly, it's something that I consider more than anything a perpetual work in progress. You never really are satisfied with what you do, just because I think there are so many moving parts that it's actually kind of impossible to nail them all. Initially, I think, you know, obviously we were just trying to make sure that we aligned the event with our personal beliefs and, of course, the larger beliefs of the yoga community. It's, more so than most. I mean,
what are your personal beliefs when it comes to that?
I guess do no harm, minimize your carbon footprint, minimize your impact, right? And so that, I mean, there are different expressions of that, but I think that, you know, when you're viewing yourself as a company with a social purpose, then obviously one of the things you have to consider is, what is my impact on the environment? It's, what is my impact on other humans? What is my impact on the environment? And inherently a festival involves thousands of people flying and driving and traveling from all over to attend. So inherently there's a, you know, relatively large impact. So, but you know, in the beginning, we just wanted to make sure that we aligned with our audience's beliefs as well. Sustainability, I think, in general, is something that you know, the yoga community in general is very passionate about and conscious of. We did things initially that were, I mean, I don't know if any of them are in themselves groundbreaking, but I guess it was a combination of things. I mean, we brought in at the time we started all the village recycling. They had recycling, but they were all two streams. So we brought in three stream recycling and had to replace all of the trash bins in the entire resort as a result. But, basically trying to separate out, obviously, out compostable. So then we had a compostable program. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, we made sure that we had all biodegradable, compostable products, cups, plates, all that sort of stuff. And things like biodiesel on generators, and really actually the preferable one is to use what they call shore power, connecting your stuff to power lines, which is possible often at ski resorts because they have all this high power from the lift system. So we were able to use shore power a lot, which is obviously has lower carbon impact. And then there's the question of what do you do with 2,000 cars and buses and trucks that are coming here? And so really the only solution to that is to get involved in the carbon offset game. We partnered with Plants, Trees, and People to try to offset the carbon emissions by planting trees and investing in renewable energy sources. Whether or not that actually is an offset is a separate question, which I'm never quite able to parse through my head, but we do the best we can in that area.
Some have said that you know, these days, you know, the next generation, the kids today, et cetera, that it's going to be, you know, impossible to, they don't even look at sort of sustainability or even like having, you know, a meaning and purpose in business as being separate from the business themselves. That's an antiquated notion that all businesses will have to have some sense of, you know, meaning, purpose, and sustainability in what they're doing just in order to exist. Do you agree with that? Does that make sense to you?
I mean, absolutely. I think not to get, you know, too political, but looking around the world that we live in, I mean, it seems that, you know, a lot of the ills that are being inflicted on the world are often the result of, you know, a sort of rapacious capitalism acting without any regard to the externalities of what it's doing. And, you know, I think you can see that across numerous industries. You can also see companies that more and more are trying to manage that. And there's simply no way that it's incompatible with a profit-driven company to also be conscious of your other impacts. I mean, you know, there's more bottom lines than just the one on how much profit you make, right? And that's how you treat your employees, and that's how you treat the environment, and that's, you know, any number of other issues, I think, you know, in ways that companies have to give back. And it seems that government is less and less active in actually managing the affairs of not only the country, but sort of improving the welfare of our citizens. And I think it does fall to corporations to step in to some degree and be conscious contributors to society. So I think millennials demand that, but I think honestly, anybody who is concerned about how the world is operating now needs to consider that too. We're in the process of finalizing our certification as a B Corp, a benefit corp. And, you know, they are great because it's a certifying body essentially. So, you know, that ensures that on a number of different standards that you are behaving in a way that is ethical and, you know, focused towards social good rather than just pure profit. And for me, it's helpful because I like a yardstick. I want to be able to measure our progress, and being part of that just means there's this intense certification process so we can measure ourselves as we improve on whatever it's how whatever benefits are on maternity leave policy or our environmental policies, or, you know, and you can go down the list, our corporate governance. There's a million different things. And you know, I think it's nice to have somebody that can judge you, because sometimes it's hard to judge yourself. And so that's something that we're interested in pursuing.
It seems to me that one of the things that seems very unusual. Now, of course, in the music business, you know, bands like the Rolling Stones will tour Croatia and then South America and then Florida. That's normal. But festivals and events don't really usually have an international component to them. I noticed that you guys were recently in New Zealand. You guys have done Europe, I think, right? Yes. That seems like really, really hard. How does that happen? And tell me about that.
Yeah, it is really hard, and it's also potentially. I'm still not convinced that from a pure business perspective, it's the smartest thing to do. But here's the truth. We called ourselves Wanderlust. We were inspired by this idea of adventure and discovery. And obviously that's internally focused through yoga, meditation practice and other things, this idea of knowing yourself. But there's also a process that's external. And, you know, we always imagine Wanderlust as being part of a global mindful movement, not being the mindful movement, but being part of something that we saw as just growing across the globe. And, you know, it was something that, you know, we felt really we could bring to other places. And I will say that the good part about what's happened is that, you know, we launched, I think, in 2010, even early on in Chile. And then we were quickly in Australia, New Zealand, and, you know, now we're in, I think 17 countries. We're on every continent that's inhabitable except for Africa, and I think we're getting there soon. So it's amazing, but, you know, I think the thing that's really striking is that everywhere we go, we'll pop up for the first time with a one-day event, one of our Wanderlust 108 Mindful Triathlon events, and, you know, you'll see immediately that the audience that comes out shares characteristics. Sure, there are different cultures and there's different languages and there's a lot of differences, but there are similar characteristics, viewpoints, and passions from the audience in, you know, St. Petersburg and in Buenos Aires and in Sydney. And that's an incredible thing to see. It makes you really feel like, yeah, we're right about that. There is a movement, and we are providing sort of a gathering point for a movement that pre-exists us, and then hopefully we can help to foster. And so from that perspective, we've wanted to do it. I would say that, you know, more logistically and business-wise, it is very challenging. I mean, we do most of the international events with licensed partners. We found some incredible partners who are really deeply passionate about the values of Wanderlust and yoga and meditation and mindfulness in general. But, you know, you're communicating across languages. We have to build this massive web platform that deals with it. We have to communicate all of the standards of the brand and make sure they're adhered to. And then, you know, obviously these people, you know, everyone has their own viewpoint. So kind of keeping the brand on point is always a challenge, but, it's a fun challenge. And, I get to go to some great places.
What's next for you guys?
I think there's two big initiatives for 2018. First of all, we're just in the process of launching a video on demand platform for instructional yoga and meditation. So you'll be able to, the idea is to really go deep with our experts, so certain people. We've worked with about 8 different people that are some of our leading teachers, and, you know, we're going to have them teach across the festivals, across the one-day events. They're going to appear in these videos, and there's really just this ability for you to be able to connect to these experts both online and offline. So I think that's kind of unique in that most of the, you know, the yoga instructional platforms that are out there, they don't really have this live in-person component that we have. So we really wanted to develop that. So we're launching that in November. I'm very excited about that. And then at the end of 2018, we have our first sort of conference style event. We're calling it Wellspring. It's a basically it's a 4-day cross, I think, you could, between one of our festivals and a giant trade show for the wellness industry generally. So we're kind of imagining it as the South by Southwest of wellness. And this takes place in Palm Springs. It's going to be a really, really cool event with a, I think, a much deeper ideas component, but still plenty of actual things you can do, practice and fitness generally and all of that, as well as, of course, like a place to showcase all these up and coming startups who are innovating in the wellness space.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to From Day One, How Brooklyn Entrepreneurs Got Their Start. This series is made possible by a grant from the Made in New York Media Center in conjunction with The Bridge, a news site dedicated to reporting on business in Brooklyn. For more from The Bridge, to learn more about today's guest, or to listen to more episodes of From Day One, visit us at thebridgebk.com. That's thebridgebk.com. From Day One is produced by Kim Thornton, Steve Kep, and myself, Nick Bailey. Audio editing and post-production by Al Sigmund. The From Day One logo was created by Joe Meyer, and our theme music was performed by Jody Rockwell and the Ambulance. Thanks for listening.